TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Chris Hedges and Richard Wolff on the 2020 elections. Biden versus Trump and Bernie Sanders, part 2 of 2. In part 1 of this program, Chris Hedges, the award-winning journalist and war reporter and New York Times best-selling author, was interviewed by Zain Raza on Activism Munich in Germany. The outcome of the November 2020 election in the U.S. is of worldwide importance. And in part 1, Chris Hedges criticized Noam Chomsky's endorsement of Biden, commented on the mistakes of the Sanders campaign, corporate media, the power of the U.S. arms industry, and the rise of fascism in the U.S. Today you will hear the conclusion of Chris Hedges' talk. Hedges puts out a reminder of how Sanders was betrayed by the Democratic Party leadership in 2016 and now again in 2020. Even though Sanders had become a loyal follower of Democratic Party politics in the intervening 4 years. Then I'll present an excerpt of an extraordinary interview of Professor Richard Wolff, also done by Activism Munich. Wolff analyzes why Bernie Sanders endorsed Joe Biden and the recurrent phenomenon of voting for the lesser of two evils. Richard Wolff is currently teaching at New School University, New York City. Here first is Chris Hedges. Zain Raza poses his question.
I want to talk about the state of the left and break it down into two parts. Part number one is Bernie Sanders had an experience in 2016 when he was sidelined, which WikiLeaks revealed by the shenanigans of the DNC. Instead, he went on knowing full well, and I talked to Glenn Greenwald about this, and he was very adamant about talking about this point, that he knew full well what the mainstream corporate billionaire media class would do, which you alluded to earlier in our interview. And he also knew how the establishment would attack him in 2020. And yet he decided to, Bernie Sanders decided to try to influence change within the Democratic apparatus. How do you view Bernie Sanders? Is he part of parcel of some criticism as well? Or should we just attribute it to external factors like the media and the DNC? So that's part one of the question. Part two of the question is a recent discussion I had with Paul Jay. And Paul Jay said, the problem with the left today is that we don't have a vision. When we talk about Medicare for all, well, we have Medicare for all in Canada and in Germany, but there's still child poverty in both of these countries. I know from Germany, there's a huge sector of people who get paid very minimum wages. It's called the minimum wage sector, as they say it. So let me summarize the two questions. Number one, do you think Bernie Sanders should receive some criticism? And part two, do you think left intellectuals or the left overall has failed to provide a vision to the population?
So in 2016, I did an event with Bernie Sanders and Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein, and the socialist city councilwoman from Seattle, Shama Sawant. And Shama pushed Bernie before the event. I was there as to why he wouldn't run as an independent, arguing correctly that we were never going to build an effective political movement in an election cycle, and we were not going to build it within the confines of the Democratic Party. Sanders' answer was that he didn't want to become Ralph Nader. What does it mean?
Could you just mention who Ralph Nader is? Could you just mention who Ralph Nader is for our young viewers in Germany?
Right. Ralph Nader is a great consumer advocate who exposed corporate power, the misuse of corporate power, wrote a series of, he was never in office, but he built a very powerful grassroots movement, wrote most of our major environmental law, the Mine and Safety Act, the Clean Water Act, these 24 pieces of legislation to protect workers and the environment, got a liberal wing of the Democratic Party to pass it through and make it law. And then, of course, with the corporate coup d'etat, to quote John Ralston Saul, that took over American politics, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party was destroyed. It existed only in rhetoric, not in actuality. Nader ran for president several times. He actually did quite well in 2000, getting almost 5% of the vote. The Democratic Party had to destroy him. They were terrified. I was Nader's speechwriter. And they did. They turned him into a pariah. And that's what Sanders meant. He knew the Democratic Party machine would destroy him. They would mount an intensive campaign to deny him his Senate seat. That's, you know, what they did to McGovern. People forget George McGovern, the last Democratic nominee to take on the military-industrial establishment. He took on the animal agriculture industry, and I would tell all your viewers to become vegan if they care about climate change, which is why I became vegan, and held hearings about the carcinogens and the danger of animal-based products as the mainstay of your diet, and they pushed him out of his Senate seat in South Dakota. So that Bernie knew what they would do, and he wasn't wrong. And so he, I think, naively believed that in the period between 2016 and 2020, he would be a loyal party member, which he was. He was endorsing all sorts of neoliberal Democratic candidates who espoused economic positions that he claims to be dead set against. And of course, after the nomination, when many of his people walked out of the, I was in Philadelphia with Cornel West. We were in a march with homeless people, several thousand homeless people surrounding the Democratic National Convention Center, appropriately named the Wells Fargo Center. And so Cornell said quite presciently to me, you know, Bernie missed his historical moment. Bernie should have walked out, and he should have spent the intervening years building a third party movement. Would he have succeeded? I mean, having worked with Ralph and seeing how dirty they play, probably not, but he would have been able to begin to build something. Instead, he became a tool of the Democratic Party, which, of course, on the eve of the North Carolina primary under Barack Obama's direction, turned on him. He knew the dirty tricks, as you pointed out. The whole Democratic National Committee was fixed against him in 2016, and yet he said nothing. It was left to Donna Brazile, you know, to expose it. And I think it was political cowardice. And now, of course, he's telling his supporters to vote for Biden. Yeah, I think it was a miscalculation, a belief that somehow the Democratic Party establishment would ever allow him to be the nominee. And as he was surging at the beginning, they made it clear what they would do. He was never going to get enough votes, 1,900 and something, on the first round. And in the second round, you have, quote-unquote, superdelegates. I think there's 700 of them, who are appointed by the party. They're all lobbyists and party officials. So it was always fixed. Bernie just wanted to be part of the club. I mean, one of the reasons Bernie didn't go after Biden on the campaign trail is because socially, especially his wife, Jane Sanders, they're friends with the Bidens. So yeah, I think Bernie failed us. We don't have any time left. I mean, because of climate change, things are deteriorating at a rate that even climate scientists never predicted. We can't fool around. Do we vote for Biden? Do we vote for Trump? Given the ecocide that is before us and the economic devastation that is, you know, weeks and months away, these kinds of questions are kind of absurd. We have to begin to do what Extinction Rebellion is doing, which is shut the damn system down. Even that may not work.
And the second part of the question, do you think the left has also generally failed to paint a vision of the future and have focused so strongly on certain issues? It does seem that when we talk within the left, there's a lot of criticism about our society, and rightfully so, but there's no way to go forward. Do you think that's been the case with the left?
Well, I think the left in Europe and the left in the United States are two different entities. And the left in Europe, and you still have communist parties in Europe, fairly strong in France and Italy. You have the Workers' Party. I'm not an expert on Germany, and I'm not going to pretend that. But you do have that, what did they poll about, what, 5%, the Labor Party. I mean, I think the United States is in far worse shape than Europe. We had a very powerful socialist movement, which was just utterly decimated and destroyed over the last century. The whole Red Scare, the red baiting, until what constituted the American left was essentially the Cold War liberal, you know, the person who was kind of liberal on social values, but hawkish in terms of defense and empire. And if you weren't, if you didn't fit within that paradigm, you were shut out. You still are shut out. That's why Chomsky's shut out. Chomsky's given no platform. When I worked at the New York Times, the editor had actually banned Chomsky's name from even if it had something to do with linguistics from the newspaper. So there is no American left. The European left is anemic and weak, but it's far healthier than where we are. And that's what's so frightening, because as we now head towards an economic decline that will certainly rival what we saw in the 1930s, we don't have those forces that we had in the 1930s, including the Communist Party, which gets written out of American history, that was able to build workers and into militant unions and fight back. And it's all gone. And of course, that empowers the very forces within the society that under the rubric of a kind of Christianized fascism will take power. People forget that Trump has an ideological void. Trump doesn't believe in anything. You know, he's just a narcissist. But that ideological vacuum has been filled by the Christian fascists. That's Pence. That's Pompeo. That's Barr. That's Betsy DeVos. There was an article in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about Betsy DeVos's brother, Eric Prince, who founded Blackwater, who uses these for-profit mercenaries. He was caught infiltrating like teachers' unions in the United States. I mean, that's kind of our equivalent of the brown shirts. And I wrote a book on the Christian right called American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War on America. And I did not use the word fascist lightly, especially since I graduated from Harvard Divinity School and grew up in the church. They're heretics. They've fused the iconography and language of American nationality with a Christian religion, just as the German Christian church did under the Nazis. And indeed, my great mentor at Harvard, James Luther Adams, was in Germany in 1935 and 1936 until he was expelled by the Gestapo, working with a confessing church, and saw, long before any of us did, the eerie and frightening similarities between the Christian right and the German Christian church, which, of course, was outlawed in Germany after the war. So America is in serious, serious trouble because of the seizure of power by corporate interests, the evisceration of our civil liberties under judicial fiat. So, you know, you have this largely through terrorism laws that have been set up initially to go after Muslims who have been seriously persecuted in the United States, but then are then used against everybody, environmental activists, animal rights activists, anybody. And a country where the pretense of democratic participation is rapidly being replaced by, you know, the heel of the boot. It's especially if you go into poor areas of the United States, it's very frightening and very ugly. I mean, we have militarized police in Kevlar vests. 1,000 citizens in the United States are killed, not to mention hundreds more shot and wounded by police every year, and almost all of them are unarmed. This is not reported. I mean, the poor in the United States, who now constitute statistically half the country, live in either poverty or near poverty, have been rendered invisible by corporate media. And I did a book with Joe Sacco. We spent 2 years on it, called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, written out of the poorest pockets of the United States, including places like Pine Ridge, South Dakota, and Indian Reservation, where the average life expectancy for a male is 48. That's the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti, and where 60% of the people don't have running water. This is the United States. It's not the United States, the corporate media, which seeks advertising dollars and of course, is dominated by huge corporations like Viacom and generally shows to the American public. But having traveled around this country for all of my books, I report on all my books, there are huge sections of the United States that might as well be the developing world, with those disparities. Where I used to live in Latin America, I used to live in Miraflores in Lima, Peru. So, which is, you know, villas that look like they could be in Miami, except the walls are higher and they have concertina wire on them. And then 10 blocks away, families are in squatting in hovels next to open sewers. I mean, that's what the United States is now. It's not what we're becoming, it's what we are.
I want to move to the last question, and I want to focus on solution aspect. You mentioned this poverty in the different regions of the United States. And one of the questions that I've asked myself is, why do so many people not vote? For example, I think in the United States, it's somewhere between 40 to 45% of people. In Germany, it's also between 20 to 30% people. Why it's not just about voting. Why don't they become active and go on the streets? And then if I ask these questions and follow that line of logic, a line of questioning, I also ask myself, why are people not consuming independent media, let alone mainstream media? Like, people are not consuming as much as information. And then the conclusion that I arrive at is that it's due to the hamster wheel, the economic system that we're part of, which I've talked to certain psychologists, and they have told me when people are under high stress levels for a prolonged period of time, what eventually happens is that the critical faculties, which are needed to process information, weigh in information, they get shut down because you're just thinking about surviving and thinking about having a food in your fridge or paying your insurance bills. And therefore, now my question comes, what do you think of a basic income, even within a capitalist system? Would that not just give some breathing room to people to consume information, politically participate, and build a movement from there on? Do you think this could be a viable solution within the capitalist system? If not, what other solutions do you think would be realistic within the circumstance that we are in?
Well, I mean, you're right. And part of it is exhaustion. I mean, people are working 70 hours a week. Nobody works harder than the poor. Barbara Ehrenreich calls being poor in the United States. Remember, we don't have health insurance. We don't have all sorts of safety nets that still exist within Europe. It's just one long emergency. There's that, and the political apathy is due also to the fact that nothing changes. Democrat, Republican, it doesn't make any difference if you're part of the working poor. Nobody's going to disarm the police. Nobody's going to give you a clean, functioning, safe public school and neighborhood. It doesn't matter. They're not wrong, and you're right. I think it's the largest voting bloc. 100 million people don't vote, but they figured out, as Emma Goldman said, that if voting was that effective, it would be illegal. You know, the left, why don't people consume? I mean, people, in order to find another narrative and hear other facts and consume alternative media, you have to be proactive. And those people are too exhausted to be proactive. They drop in front of their screens or their, you know, computers or televisions and consume the electronic hallucinations corporate power feeds them. And that's bread and circus. I studied classics. It's all what the arena was. Why writers like Cicero, who cared about civic society, inveighed against the bread and circus in the arenas, because he saw how a beleaguered population, remember, there were vast economic disparities in the late Roman Empire between the oligarchs and the citizenry. He saw how the citizenry invested their emotional and intellectual life in violence and the tawdry and the salacious. And that's exactly what's happened. So, you know, what is the response? It is to recover a new militancy where we recognize that our planet will not be saved and our democracy will not be restored through existing political systems. And Extinction Rebellion has it right. It's why I've supported them and indeed participated in their activities. We shut down the street in front of the New York Stock Exchange last fall. It has to be prolonged. It has to be sustained. It has to have larger numbers. But we have to begin to do, you know, what indigenous peoples did at Standing Rock, what the Quebec student movement did a few years ago. That's our only hope. We have seen popular uprisings in Chile and Spain and Lebanon, but that's the only mechanism left. I don't know if it's going to succeed, but I can tell you voting for Joe Biden definitely ain't going to succeed.
That was Chris Hedges. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, a New York Times best-selling author, a professor at Rutgers University, and an ordained Presbyterian minister. He has written 12 books, including the best-selling American Fascists, The Christian Right, and the War on America. His latest book is America, The Farewell Tour. He was interviewed by Zain Raza on May 5, 2020, on Activism Munich in Germany. In an effort to compare opinions on the 2020 U.S. elections, Zain Raza also spoke with Professor Richard Wolff on Bernie Sanders' endorsement of Joe Biden and voting for the lesser of two evils. Richard Wolff is Professor of Economics Emeritus, currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in International Affairs of the New School University, New York City. Here is Zain Raza asking Richard Wolff a very thoughtful question.
Switching to U.S. domestic politics, right now Bernie Sanders endorsed Joe Biden. Even figures on the left like Noam Chomsky have said that Joe Biden's presidency could potentially have more channels of democracy and public participation, which could influence policy. While on the other, the left is split, which says we are done with the voting of lesser two evils. How do you see this perspective, this reformist perspective? I'm rephrasing here. I think it's a reformist perspective. Do you see Chomsky's view as being a way that we can, through Biden, still influence policy and have more channels like trade unions and nurses unions available to influence policy? Or are you completely avoiding this debate about, and you see both Biden and Trump as part of the same coin?
No, and I don't phrase it quite that way. I'm very disappointed that Bernie withdrew from the race, and I'm even more disappointed that he endorsed Biden. Biden is better than Trump. That seems clear to me, but it's almost meaningless because that's such a low bar that the statement is sort of boring. Almost anybody would have been better than Trump. Certainly any one of the 20 people who at various times said they wanted to be president in the Democratic Party would have been better than Trump. I mean, who cares? Yes, it's better than Trump. And when it comes to voting, yeah, I suppose we'll vote for Biden. No one's going to vote for Trump for 20 different reasons. But for the left, Mr. Biden is a zero. There's nothing there. It's what we call an empty suit. This is an old, probably senile, representative of an old, certainly senile establishment of the Democratic Party. This is the Clintons. This is Obama. And this is all the old apparatchiks of the Democratic Party who are terrified by Bernie. Who take money from the corporate elite, who are, you know, the center left in a game with the center right. So for me, the job of the left is what it was before. Only I appreciate Bernie because he strengthened us. He did two things. Number one, he taught millions of Americans that they are not alone and that they are not isolated. He taught them and he taught the whole world that there's an enormous constituency for anti-capitalism and for socialism, whatever the vague understanding of those terms, and it is vague. But he taught the world that the United States is not the place where there can't be socialism. That is an enormous step forward for us. He also made the daily conversation about socialism acceptable, which, speaking very personally, has opened the door for people like me in a way that did not exist in the totality of my lifetime here in the United States. So I feel an enormous debt to Bernie, even though I disagree with and am disappointed by his decisions. But he built a foundation that we ought to be building on now. For the time being, those of us who want to build a la Bernie, a kind of moderate socialism within the Democratic Party, I say, fine, do it. And for those of us who want to build outside the Democratic Party, build an alternative socialist party that can be much more aggressive, much more explicit, go much further. I say, do it. My activity will be with the second group, personally, not the first one. I'm not interested in building it inside the Democratic Party. But I understand there are many people who are, and I would advise those and those that I'm with, the ones who want to build independently, that people change over time. And we need a movement that welcomes people who want to do it in the Democratic Party, just like we should welcome people who don't. And we should understand that the problems that will be given by the old established Democrats to those like Bernie or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or the others like that, there will be movement of those people. And if they get disappointed by the Democratic Party, their commitment to socialism will bring them to us. And we have to welcome that. We have to make that as easy a process as possible. And I would remind Americans, I don't need to do it with your audience, the Die Linke Party is a merger of a wing of the SPD and of the old Eastern German. And that kind of an alliance can also emerge in this country between the socialist wing of the Democratic Party and the independent socialism that is emerging.
That was Professor Richard Wolff, now at New School University, New York City. Earlier, he taught economics at Yale University and at City College of the City University of New York. In 1994, he was visiting professor of economics at the University of Paris, France. Wolff was also a regular lecturer at the Bertolt Brecht Forum in New York City until it closed in 2014. Hat tip and thanks to Zain Raza for both interviews. The full interviews of Chris Hedges and Richard Wolff can be found on the web and social media sites of Activism Munich. That's a non-profit, independent online media portal. Zain Raza founded Activism in 2013 and is the senior editor. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term, the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.